You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, James Sodeth on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Stephen Katz. Your Honors, in this case, the lion's share of my argument, as well as the lion's share of the district court, hinged its opinion upon the issue of waiver, and so I am going to spend the majority of my argument talking about the issue of waiver, but before I turn to waiver, I do think it's important for me to briefly make a point on this case came before the court in terms of a motion for summary judgment. And one of the most glaring, I think, errors, though the vast majority of the district court, again, did not reach a lot of the fact disputes in this case because of the issue of waiver, one of the areas where they did actually reach one of the fact disputes, because this is an age discrimination case, was in the issue of the key decision maker in this case, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Adams. Brian Adams makes a comment in his deposition that, and just as a brief background, Your Honors, that this is occurring out at Fort Polk, now Fort Johnson, at the Army Community Hospital out there. You may hear me refer to it as BJAC. It's the Bain Jones Army Community Hospital. Out at the Bain Jones Army Community Hospital, there are two surgeons there. In this case, Brian Adams is implementing what they call a HELOS reset, H-E-L-O-S, a HELOS reset. We have always contended that the HELOS reset was simply pretext for actually implementing age discrimination. However, it became crystal clear during the deposition of Colonel Adams, because in that testimony, Lieutenant Colonel Adams finally admits that the HELOS reset did not actually mandate that Dr. Stephen Katz be removed from his position and someone younger placed into his spot. Previously, that had always been the argument. We had to do this because of HELOS. It changed in the deposition, and finally we hear in the deposition that the real reason was he had a desire to place someone younger, use that word, a younger military officer into that position. Now the district court, when they dispensed with the word young, did so by essentially stating that, well, there are two interpretations of the word young. Young could be viewed as age. Young could also be viewed in terms of experience. The district court adopted the interpretation actually most opposed to the non-moving party. They adopted the interpretation most contrary to Dr. Stephen Katz. They adopted the interpretation that young in this case must have meant experience, though Mr. Adams or Colonel Adams never expressly stated that that's what he intended by the word young. The district court insinuated or concluded that must have been their intent. That was one of the most glaring examples of construing facts against the non-movement. I think it's important for Your Honors to know that in this case, it is riddled with fact disputes, but I do realize that we've got to get past the issue of waiver to get to a lot of those fact disputes, and so now I want to turn to the issue of waiver. In this case, Dr. Stephen Katz does make his ultimate contact with the EEO, the internal agency for the Army, after 45 days. And the Army's thrust of their argument, at least finally at the district court, was, well, if you did not appear within 45 days, you've waived that. I think the fundamental problem in this case has been a misinterpretation or a misconstruction of this court's line of jurisprudence regarding waiver. And if I can, just briefly, we start with the Huntley case, which is the first time that this circuit holds that, in fact, because it's not jurisdictional, this 45 days is subject to waiver, tolling, estoppel, etc. And so Huntley comes up with the broad principle that, well, we will allow waiver if the agency, quote, acts on it. Now, the Oaxaca case is the first time that's sort of tailored back. That's brought back somewhat by this court to say, just because an agency acts on it doesn't mean it's an automatic. So just because you receive the complaint, you docket the complaint, you accept the complaint, even if you investigate the complaint, that's not going to be enough. We're not going to allow you an automatic extension. Okay, fair enough as it goes. It finally moves to the Munoz case. And the Munoz case is dealing with the agency of the Air Force. And the Munoz case, I think, is where this line of jurisprudence currently leaves us. The Munoz case adopts Huntley and says, fine, if you accept it and you act on it, it accepts the tailor back of Oaxaca, that, well, it can't be automatic, but here's what Munoz says. If you accept it, if you act upon it, that may not be enough under Oaxaca, but you have to do, quote, a good deal more. And that becomes our standard. What is, quote, a good deal more? Now, in the Munoz case, what was, quote, a good deal more was that in that case, the EEO had actually made an express finding that the internal agency, the EEO, the internal agency for the Air Force had made an express finding that the complaint was timely. So it almost became a judicially stopped from changing your position argument that at one point in time it was found to be timely. Now all of a sudden the argument's being made by the agency that it's untimely. But in the Munoz case, they never at any point in time expressly stated that the only way by which you can have waiver is an express finding of timeliness. What they said was you have to have, quote, a good deal more. And the question became in Munoz, well, what are the facts of the Munoz case that constitute a good deal more? And that was the finding of timeliness. Where I think this sort of goes off the rails in this line or progeny of cases is the Roe case, Roe versus Sullivan. The Roe case is cited to, and by the way, all of the companion string cites of cases that my colleague on the other side is going to cite to, Werner, Reveles, Adams, Daniels, Molina, all of these cases, they cite to Roe. They're underlying.
I agree with you that it went off the rails at Roe and that our progeny is wrong and that the Seventh Circuit is right. Even if we agree with all of that, how can we help you today, sir? Because we have to follow our rule of orderliness. And there's those are published cases, Munoz and Roe, even if these other ones, Werner and Rivlet, are not, I think. So aren't we stuck? Are you trying to make an argument that you want to save for en banc or something?
No, I'm not trying to save for en banc because I don't think that I'm stuck with Munoz because Munoz, I was going to say that Munoz is my best case with the Fifth Circuit because it is a published opinion. And what Munoz holds is that there is no holding inside of Munoz that you must have an express finding of timeliness. What Munoz says is a good deal more. And so I don't think this court is deviating from its rule of orderliness whenever it says, under the facts of the Katz case, here's what we have. We have an individual who ostensibly the complaint is after the 45 days, but the EEO for the Army dockets that complaint, they accept it, they investigate it. Whenever Judge Rung, the administrative law judge, whenever he issues his pretrial order and scheduling order and discovery deadlines, the parties agree.
Well, go ahead and finish your thought.
Okay, sorry. Thank you, Judge. The parties agreed to accepting two claims, none of which were timeliness. Timeliness was never urged at the lower court. Even when we get to the district court, timeliness is never raised, even in a 12B6 motion to dismiss. Finally, the case is fully litigated until a motion for summary judgment. At the motion for summary judgment stage, that's when, at the first time, the issue of timeliness is ever raised. And so my position, Your Honor, is that under Munoz, there has been, quote, a good deal more. There has been far more than just acceptance and docketing by the EEO office, but rather—
Roe doesn't do this good deal more. It just says you must have a specific finding that the claimant's submission was timely.
All due respect, Your Honor, I disagree. Munoz—
Disagree with Roe? Or you're disagreeing with my reading of Roe? I'm reading directly from Roe.
I'm sorry, I thought you said Munoz.
No, Roe.
Roe does say that, yes.
Roe says that. We're stuck with Roe, aren't we?
Respectfully, no, actually we're not. We're not, and here's why. This is the problem with Roe. In Roe, Mr. Roe is a pro se plaintiff. He is an attorney, actually, who had defended the government in these kind of Title VII cases in the past. The court did not want to extend to him equitable estoppel or tolling because he was deemed to be a sophisticated and learned party. But the issue with Mr. Roe was, after the EEOC had done its entire process, or the internal agency, the EEO, because in Roe's case, he was with the HHS, Health and Human Services Department. That was his agency, was HHS. When he files his motion to reconsider, not talking about the original complaint to the agency, he files a reconsideration request to the commission, to the EEOC commission. When he does that, he doesn't do that particular request timely. He does it after the 30-day mark. I'm not talking about the original 45 days necessary to initiate your internal complaint. What he submitted was a request for reconsideration to the commission, to a third-party tribunal. And this is the problem. Every single case has been citing Roe sort of blithely without looking at the facts of Roe. There is a distinction between the agency employer in these federal sector cases. The agency employer is either the Air Force, the Army, the HHS, the VA, whatever it is. The EEOC is viewed as the commission. Even the implementing regulations, the statutes, 29 CFR 1614.105, all of these CFRs talk about the difference between the agency or the commission. There is a separation between the internal agency process, the EEO, and the EEOC, which is acting as a third-party commission. And that makes sense as a practical standpoint that a third-party commission, a third-party tribunal, would not in any way be in a position to waive the rights or waive the defense of a defendant, of an agency. In fact, part of Roe's argument that I think practically was a struggle was that if the court would have adopted Roe's argument was essentially, well, the minute the tribunal, the minute the commission docketed my request, it somehow accepted my request. Well, we can see through how that doesn't make sense, because under Roe's argument, I guess the EEOC was supposed to throw in the trash his reconsideration motion and not even docket it. Instead, what the EEOC did was they simply docketed it, and they denied it because it was late, it was after the 30 days.
Assuming, arguendo, that we don't agree with your distinction of Roe, even if it has intuitive appeal, just assuming, arguendo, what claims do you believe survive, and should you win on?
Assuming, arguendo, that we do get past waiver, I think there are, first of all, I'll say we voluntarily dismissed the religious claim. After doing discovery in the case, we felt it became clear that
you don't get past the waiver issue. What claims still are here? You have some claims that are okay, don't you?
Your Honor, I'll double check myself when I come back up.
You think you lose the whole case?
I think that we lose the entire case if we lose on waiver, yes.
I think you lose retaliation, constructive discharge.
There is a caveat to that, Judge Willett. Thank you. As to the issue of the retaliation, the constructive discharge, one of the issues there is that we get into the continuing violation doctrine. And so I don't think that I lose on the waiver issue, because in the particular facts of that case, Dr. Katz's summary suspension, his abeyance, is supposed to last for a period of 30 days. One of the other doctors on site at BJAC was Dr. Isaiah. He went through the same process Dr. Katz did. Dr. Isaiah's lasted 30 days. They hired an internal investigative agency or officer, an IO. That IO came back and said everything is fine. Dr. Isaiah was reinstated. Dr. Katz went through an IO. That IO came back and said everything is fine. Dr. Katz is not reinstated. Instead, what the panel does is they then find new allegations to bring against Dr. Katz, and this time they elevate it or they send it back to the IO. He comes back once again, says everything is fine. At that point in time, the panel at BJAC is still not satisfied. They send him to a peer review panel. That peer review panel, while it is still out, ultimately it comes back and says everything is fine. But at this point, despite two IOs and a peer review panel now spanning a period of years that he's been under summary suspension, can't practice as a surgeon, Dr. Katz, again, for summary judgment purposes, is, you know, construing this in light most favorable to Dr. Katz, he testifies he had a conversation with leadership where they threatened to report him to the data bank if he did not quit. The data bank, I didn't know what it was, so if your honors are not familiar with what it is, the data bank is absolutely devastating if you're a surgeon. It's what any prospective employer looks at. If you have sort of a mention in the data bank, it might as well be considered malpractice, a scarlet letter on that surgeon. The last thing they want to do is be in a data bank. It desperately can hinder their career. When the threat comes to go to the data bank, he finally quits. So we think that any reasonable person in Dr. Katz's position, a jury would find that is a constructive discharge. It is not until after Dr. Katz feels as though he has no choice but to resign. He does resign. It is after his resignation that the panel finally reinstates his privileges. But at no point in time during his entire employment there did they ever reinstate his privileges, despite what we saw happening at the exact same parallel time with Dr. Isaiah. And so under the continuing violation doctrine, I do think that I get past the waiver issue because of the fact that the time delay would run, and you can look at the Vidal versus Chertoff case.
But your EEOC complaint, why isn't that good enough for your retaliation constructive discharge claim? Why isn't that, wasn't it exhausted appropriately in that? and it's not untimely, and so why isn't that a viable claim? This is actually a friendly question.
It is a friendly question, and I would happen to agree with Your Honor, but I'll sit down and save my last 5 minutes. We'll talk about
it. No, so what's the answer?
Well, I do think that the EEOC claim that we presented does save our claims. In fact, we did talk about that to the district court in the case of, I want to make sure I cite it correctly, the Monkus versus Johans case. In the Monkus case, we talked about that. We felt that was enough to get us past this. The district court disagreed and found everything on waiver. We think that we actually do get past without having to get into waiver.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
If you don't mind, can you start with those that don't allegedly affect the waiver?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm nervous, ma'am.
It's okay. Take a deep breath. We get through this.
My name is Annette Perry, and I represent the Secretary of the Army. So I'm going to get past. The big thing is none of plaintiff's arguments excuse his failure to timely exhaust his claims. And so we'll shoot past the removal of the supervisory duties and the abeyance, as both of those are clearly outside of the 45 days, and I think that the precedent is pretty clear that those weren't timely exhausted. But it's the same for his retaliation claim, so I'll focus there.
I don't want you to get off, so if you want to start somewhere else, you start where you want to start.
I'll start the continuing violation doctrine. The district court properly rejected the argument that the delayed investigation caused the abeyance and continued suspension of Katz's privileges did not constitute a continuing violation. Discreet acts, which he includes the removal and the abeyance, they must be exhausted under Morgan within 45 days. Katz's contention that the investigation was unreasonably delayed is unsupported by the record evidence. Both Dr. Katz and Dr. Isaiah's clinical privileges were placed in abeyance in August of 2018. Both converted to summary suspensions in September of 2018. On October 10th, the credentialing committee met, and they discussed both the IA findings for Dr. Katz and for Dr. Isaiah. By that point, Colonel Adams, the alleged discriminator, he had already recused himself from the credentials committee, so he was not even in this meeting. And it was brought up additional allegations that had been found in a separate investigation within the Department of Surgery. And they asked the investigator if he had looked into those matters. And he said he had not. So he went back and looked at those. It was determined when he came back that peer review was necessary, but they couldn't do it from physicians. They had to find a panel outside of BJAC because these were the only two general surgeons that they had. And so that's what took the time. They're making a big deal about that the peer review panel found that Dr. Katz's privileges should be reinstated in December, but they didn't reinstate them until after he resigned. But that's simply not true. They did meet, but if you look at their actual recommendation, they didn't sign it until mid-January, and by that point, and then they submitted it back to BJAC leadership to make a decision. And Dr. Katz had already resigned by that point. And the record clearly shows that after they received the findings, within 2 weeks, his privileges were reinstated. Dr. Katz has not showed, bottom line, he has presented no substantial evidence to support his claim that there was a delay in the investigation.
So, can you tell us why the EEO complaint is not satisfactory? Because we don't require a check the box. If it's detailed in what the allegations are, especially after the Fort Bend County case with everything being, it's mandatory but not jurisdictional, and we're not. Why isn't it good enough?
Because he doesn't allege any claims of retaliation, anything that could be construed as retaliation in either the December 28th, 2018 EEO complaint, or the plaintiffs have characterized it as clarification. It's actually it's listed as the fourth page of the EEO complaint, and it's the response to the claimed relief. And neither one of those, and according to plaintiff, I don't know how to verify it, but according to plaintiff, it was submitted on January 3rd, which was the day after he was terminated. There's no mention of an alleged threat. There's no mention of retaliation in either of those documents. And furthermore, on January 10th, the EEO office sent a notice of accepted claims, and they only included the removal of the supervisory duties and the clinical abeyance as the listed claims before them. And plaintiff was given 5 days. It instructed him if within 5 days he didn't agree with the way that they framed his issues, he had 5 days to tell him so, and he didn't. And he was represented by counsel at that time. So I think that between those three documents, it's undisputed that he did not exhaust his retaliation claim.
Would you like to address whether Roe controls the situation without, where it's a third party administrator like the EEOC, a third party agency versus the agency where the action's occurring, that distinction that's being made?
I don't think there is any distinction, Your Honor.
Well, does the Seventh Circuit make that distinction?
The Seventh Circuit does, but we rejected that in Adams v. Potter.
And who's we?
The Fifth Circuit, I'm sorry. This circuit. They rejected that in Adams v. Potter, even though it was a Eastern District, Louisiana case in 2005. This court affirmed that decision, and it's directly on point with this case. It was a postal worker. He went through administrative process. The EEOC administrative judge rendered a decision finding that he did
is
not.
Is that a published opinion where we
say
we reject that? Okay. Is there, given that we don't have to follow the unpublished opinions under the way our rule of orderliness works, what is the right answer?
The right answer, Your Honor, is that at the administrative level, an employee should be given the benefit of the doubt and a thorough investigation should be done. That was the intent of the Civil Service Reform Act and an open and fair investigation into the claims. If the court were to require that at the administrative level for the agency to make that determination, viable claims could be lost in the process.
Okay, so you think that's a result of the Seventh Circuit approach?
I think it's possible, ma'am.
Do you know of any other circuits that handle this any other ways?
The Lord case out of the Sixth Circuit, if all of the claims would be dismissed, then you waive it if you don't bring up the timeliness argument at the administrative level. So it's a little bit, I think Lord was the case.
So would Sixth Circuit then be against this also in this case?
Not in this case, Your Honor, because all claims wouldn't have been dismissed.
What case wouldn't be dismissed?
On the timeliness argument. because it wasn't within the 45 days. Not sure, Your Honor. I don't think it may well have disposed all of them. I'm trying to work it through my head, right, if under that standard.
Any other circuits that you wish to call out to us?
No, Your Honor. The Fifth Circuit has consistently held that that's what the standard is. I think that it's longstanding precedent that plaintiff is asking us, we're asking the court to overrule.
Longstanding precedent.
Yes, Your Honor. This has been that the timeliness defense is waived only when the agency makes a specific finding, which they didn't do in this case. It wasn't addressed at the administrative level.
Do you have anything further?
There's a couple of things I would like to note. First, plaintiff was represented by counsel. There was some suggestion that he wasn't throughout the administrative process, that the Army didn't bring this up until our summary judgment, didn't bring up the exhaustion argument until the summary judgment motion, but in fact, throughout the court litigation, beginning with our affirmative defenses and our answer, the Army's position has been that plaintiff failed to timely exhaust these claims. Would you like me to address the Younger comments?
It's up to you what you want to do with your time. I think we have your argument, but if you want to address something,
you have my, I apologize. The Younger comment, and if you read it in the context, it was clear there were two actions here. The first was, while the Army wasn't required under HELOS to change the only civilian department head position at BJAC, from civilian to military. They weren't required to do it, but what did happen is that their department head positions were reduced by half. And this is what we do, right? We train and develop leaders. If you read it in context, what Dr. Adams had said, it's that they needed these positions to groom these young officers, right, for further advancement. And so, I think plaintiff's argument is off point. It's just completely out of context.
If you need positions to groom young officers, why isn't that a prima facie case of picking young people over more senior people?
As young doesn't necessarily mean you're ma'am young in age. It is intended to be. We commonly refer to our military officers based on rank.
Why isn't that a jury issue? Whether you meant young, like
it's not
dictionary, or young, like military. I just don't know if that's your best argument, but that's anyway. Anything else?
No, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Willett and Judge Elrod, let me address what we were talking about whenever we last left off, whether or not I survive regardless of waiver, put Roe and waiver aside. A few points. First of all, I think that with his formal complaint being filed December 28th, 2018, I think the summary suspension does come back. I think it does survive. Any retaliation, by the way, before the summary suspension, so basically back to the abeyance, because of the continuing violation doctrine, which I discussed before under Vital versus Chertoff, I think if the summary suspension comes in, then I think any retaliation prior to the summary suspension, meaning related to the abeyance, comes in under Vital versus Chertoff. Finally, let me address retaliation though post. Not pre-retaliation, which would be governed by Vital, but post-retaliation after December 28, 2018. I do think under the Gupta line of cases, which I think is what Judge Elrod, you were referring to. The Sanchez case has the beautiful language about not requiring it to be for the sophisticated or the learned, but rather so it's not so much about checking the box, but what the contents of the allegations are. So under Gupta, which allows for retaliation to arise post the original forming of the complaint, I think post-retaliation comes in through Gupta and its progeny. But I do want to raise, though, because there was an argument made by my counsel, opposing counsel, that, well, he didn't check the box of reprisal. So that is sort of a concern for me. If waiver doesn't happen and I'm limited to my complaint, well, then what do you do with the fact that your complaint doesn't specifically check the box of reprisal? As your honors are well aware, there is no formal requirement to simply check the box. It's what can grow out of that investigation. And I'd hate to do this to simply read my brief, but I do think it's important on this narrow point that even though after he submitted his complaint, he didn't check the box, he had a follow-up contact with the EEO officer, in this case, Karen Mataggi, an email correspondence that he had. And this is exactly what the courts envision happening. What can, quote, grow out of the charge? You may not check the exact box in your charge, but this is what we expect to happen in this process, the interactive process with the EEO. There's going to be communication between yourself and that officer. My client, Dr. Katz, sends an email to Karen Mataggi with the EEO, and he talks about, in detail, his position on how he felt this was retaliatory. He ends his email with this, quote, "In my case, it was retaliatory and meant to be injurious by Adams. Record on Appeal 163738. My client, though he may not have checked the box, I do think that retaliation survives because of what grew out of the original charge. So those would be the things I think that survive this case if waiver is not granted. As a final point to go back to Roe and the issue of orderliness, to answer your question, Judge Elrod, there is no published opinion in the Fifth Circuit. The Seventh Circuit has the published opinion, which I do think is not only directly analogous and on point, I think it meets all the practical concerns of showing deference to the administrative process, completing the record, and having judicial economy. And I don't think that this court needs to overrule Roe or do anything to Roe. What Roe deals with, it's not a distinction without a difference. It is a major distinction within the CFR between an agency, a federal agency, and a third-party commission or tribunal. And so for a third-party commission or tribunal to docket a request, to rule on that request, stands on its own. It would be illogical, I think, too far of a leap to say that what a tribunal does, its actions, thereby constitutes waiver on the part of the agency. That's the argument in Roe that I don't follow, that what a third party does would somehow impute waiver on the agency. If I want to find waiver by the Army or waiver by the agency, I want to look at what the agency itself did. What actions did it take? And in this case, not only did it never raise this till summary judgment, they are right, they brought it up in a boilerplate affirmative defense. But if they really felt as though timeliness was an issue, a 12B6 could have dispensed with this very quickly if they really felt that timeliness was an issue. A final point on what the agency did in this case, there was a brief moment, by the way, and this is in my brief, there's a brief moment at the very beginning of this when Dr. Katz submits his initial 40, it was after the 45-day mark, he submits his initial complaint, the informal one. And Karen Mataggi, with the internal agency, not the EOC, with the internal agency, she actually reaches out to Dr. Katz and she says, "Why are you outside of the 45 days? And he responds with an email about the fact that, well, he thought he was going to have a union representative. He ended up not getting a union representative, and he wasn't sure through his internal grievance counselor that they have on site. He wasn't sure what the timeliness concerns were. And then she processes it post. Why is this compelling? Because in all of the cases that talk about this waiver issue, they talk about the desire for this is to avoid negligence or inadvertence. We don't want an agency to be bound if they're inadvertent. So for those reasons, we ask that the court be reversed. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. We have your arguments. We appreciate them. This case is submitted. The court will stand in recess until tomorrow.